The king of Indianapolis Motor Speedway is now the owner of Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Our motorsports writer Adam Stern takes us inside Roger Penske's purchase of the fabled property and the racing circuit that came along with it. We'll also talk to Adam about the video game world and what he's got his eye on there. Then we'll bring in our Brett McCormick for a conversation about college football rivalries and cranberries and an 8-foot-tall, 400-pound trophy named Chief Caddo. Trust me, you want to hear more. Those and whatever else comes up once we get talking here in the newsroom of Sports Business Journal. I'm Bill King, and this is First Look. They call Roger Penske the captain. I'm going to do all I can to refrain from using that in a metaphor to set up this next segment. It's tempting. But I will refrain and simply report that Roger Penske, titan of industry and winner of the storied Indy 500, a record 18 times as a car owner, now owns the Indy 500. That's Indianapolis Motor Speedway, the Indy Racing League, and some associated properties acquired from the Holman George family for about $300 million last week. In to talk about that is our motorsports writer Adam Stern, who took a look at the deal in this week's issue. Adam, to an outsider, it felt like that deal came out of nowhere. How about to insiders?
A little bit of both. Yeah. You know, insiders had a feeling that the company might be sold, but what happened was is the CEO, who is a very open and honest person, continued to insist that they weren't for sale.
And who's that?
Mark Miles.
Okay.
And you know, at the end of the day, he was just doing what he had to do.
Right.
But it kind of threw, I think, a good bit of people off the trail. But at the end of the day, you know, Mary Holman George, who was the matriarch of the family, she died last year. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of people who were wondering, do they have to do estate planning? Then earlier this year, they sold their baking powder company. They happen to have diversified interests. They literally have a
right.
They had a baking powder right. company called Clabber Girl. So they sold that in May. And at the time, people said, wow, OK, now this is starting to match up. Now, I spoke with Mark Miles this week, which is now will be last week when people hear
this. Right.
And he was saying that, you know, actually they've entertained all sorts of offers over the years and that it wasn't specifically just because this matriarch, Mary Holman George, died that it ended up happening, but just that the family was kind of looking at their options. They were looking at, do we bring in a minority partner and stay as the majority partner? They were looking at some real estate deals where they would have stayed on but brought in strategic partners.
Right.
And ultimately, one way or the other, they decided to do a full exit. And that apparently happened very late in the game, like, you know, mid to late summer. And so at that point, Tony George, who is the chairman
right.
of Holman & Company with these racing
right.
assets, went to Roger Penske on the grid and basically found him and said, do you want to buy this? And apparently there was multiple bidders. You know, media reports last week identified Formula One's owner,
right.
Liberty Media's
right.
one. We understand that there were, you know, multiple bidders, and even in a couple years ago, so not recently, not in this round of bidding, but a couple years ago, Endeavor, IMG took a look
right.
at buying this property. So over the years, there had been some interest. They had done a great job of kind of keeping people away from hearing the truth about it. And, you know, they operated and did this deal very, you know, shrouded in secrecy. They kept the deal to roughly about 8 to 10 people on both sides in total. So 4 to 5 people on both sides.
Right.
And I'm hearing amazing stories about how literally Indianapolis Motor Speedway and IndyCar executives, some very major executives, were not told until literally a day or even the day of, a day before or the day of.
The closing.
Mark Miles did not tell some of his top key lieutenants about this because they were trying to keep it that secretive.
Right.
You know, Indianapolis Motor Speedway president Doug Bowles has admitted he was one. He was at Texas Motor Speedway last weekend on Saturday night, and he was called and he was summoned back. And from what I understand, he had some other business to attend to, and he basically made them tell him on the phone, like, why do you need me to come back to Indianapolis? Because I'm not scheduled to be back there right now. So they kept this deal very, very tight. Mark Miles said that he did it because they wanted, you know, both sides wanted, you know, all the employees and all the stakeholders to hear it first from them.
Right.
They'd rather not come through the rumor mill. But yes, this one came out of absolutely nowhere. You know, Roger Penske is famous for, you know, getting loyalty from his employees
mm-hmm.
and them keeping things very close to the vest. So it's classic Roger Penske. But, you know, for a deal of this magnitude to have stayed as quiet as it did was simply
astonishing.
Stunning.
It wouldn't have been that way if it had been on Endeavor. It wouldn't have been that way if it had been Liberty, right? I mean, it's just highly unlikely. But that is and that's a great segue into the fact that it's Roger Penske. And what does that mean in the racing world?
I mean, the racing world means first class in everything he does. You know, he has the Midas touch. I mean, there's really very few things he's ever been involved with that haven't worked out well. And that's in racing and business. He's, you know, his team is far and away the most successful IndyCar team ever, having won an astonishing 18 Indy 500s. They've done well in NASCAR, and they're newer to NASCAR, but they've still won a couple championships in there and win many races. So he's just seen as being first class everything he does. You know, while he is a, you know, he's involved in truck leasing and car sales, and he's involved with this race team, they also have a history with owning tracks and putting on races.
California Speedway.
He built California Speedway, now known as Auto Club Speedway. They managed Michigan International Speedway, which is near his headquarters in Michigan, Bloomfield Hills. And they still, to this day, run the Belle Isle Detroit Grand Prix race, which has IndyCar and IMSA races annually.
It was a long time ago, but they had a it wasn't just California, Michigan, right? They had a, they had a chain of tracks. I mean, they were in the Speedway business before.
That's exactly right. And we spoke to their executive vice president of Penske Corporation this week, Jonathan Gibson. And he said, look, this is in our wheelhouse. This is our capability. We run events. We know how to own tracks. You know, Greg Penske, who used to help out with running California Speedway.
Greg was the president of California Speedway.
He was at the track this week right alongside his dad. I don't think that was by mistake. I'm not saying it was only symbolic, but it certainly wasn't by mistake. And so, you know, this is what the family knows how to do this. Now, this is a big step up to running the IndyCar series, to run the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. But Roger Penske, you know, he's someone who I think he has sentimental value and connection to this track. And then he also sees it as a business that's within his wheelhouse that he thinks can turn into a good investment. So ultimately, he decided to take a pretty risky bet and step up here.
I think it also brings a ton of credibility to open wheel racing. And that really is, I think, what where part of the struggle has been is that there was this jewel of a property, the Indy 500. And then there was this lesser property, the Indy Racing League, or whatever it might be called in its latest iteration, right? It's just never been able to get racing term traction. Here you bring in this guy who's been involved as both a team owner and a speedway operator, and it'll be really interesting to see how that gravitas might help them turn the corner if it does.
Yeah, you know, IndyCar used to rival NASCAR with their viewership and their attendance, and then they went through the infamous split where there was the dispute between the league and team owners. Split into two different leagues, and it never really recovered and eventually reunified, but it hasn't really recovered since. We spoke to Bobby Rahal this week, one of the team owners, and he said he thinks just from Roger coming aboard, it adds so much, and not because of his success in racing. It's his success in business and his respect in business that is going to make this a big deal. You know, his people this week, when people are hearing it, it'll be this week.
Right.
Penske Corporation, people are meeting with IndyCar executives this week about sponsorship. Hey, how can we help you out? How can we talk to some of our partners? How can we do things here and there to start helping selling more sponsorships? So they're getting right after. They're getting right into it. And that's a great area. And that's going to be an area that will be able to show their help, because Penske Corporation, I was speaking again to Jonathan Gibson from the Penske Corporation. He reminded me, I think if I'm getting this right, their average tenure of sponsors is 12 years. I mean, that's superb in this day and age. So they do really well with sponsors. They do really well with business to business connections. And so, you know, let's see. They might have some new sponsors kind of step up, whether it's some of their partners or just the momentum of this overall. And that'll be kind of a good early bellwether of whether this will be a successful venture.
Ton of excitement around this deal right now. One of the first questions that I think, and it may take a while, but certainly by the time we get to next May, it'll be resolved before next May, but you will start to hear that question about, okay, wait a minute now. The guy who owns the most successful team in the history of this Speedway now also owns the Speedway and, oh, by the way, owns the league. That can't work, right?
Yeah, so that's definitely a fair point. You know, obviously he used to have an ownership stake in CART, but he wasn't the only person.
Now, well, they all had it. The team owners own CART.
That's right. So that's where it's different. You know, he got asked that question in the press conference on Monday. And what he said was, I'm stepping down as race strategist for the Team Penske car that I work with.
That's going to be incredibly difficult for him.
Yeah, I mean, he loves being at the track. You know, there's the famous stories about how at the 24-hour races the past 2 years, his team has been running a 24-hour Rolex race at Daytona. He stayed up all 24 hours. I mean, the guy is a machine.
He at age 82, which is astonishing. You know, I did our profile on him when we named him a champion a few years ago. And one of the memories I'll always take away was sitting behind find him up in the what is in essence Penske's control center up above the track. And by the way, for years Roger was on the pit box, right? So they at least got that step backwards. But he was talking pit strategy. He was making calls. He was doing all those things that an engaged team owner does. Roger was a racer. Roger was a driver. Roger didn't come into this as a wealthy guy with toys. I mean, he came from the track, from the pits. So my God, it's going to be a cultural shock for him to be at a speedway on a Sunday and not be on a, you know, making calls.
Yeah. I mean, he says all the time, he always jokes, you know, as far as like his wife says, like that's his golfing, like going
right
to the track.
That's right.
And so, you know, it is going to nod him a little bit, I think, to kind of step down from that. But clearly he said, hey, look, for my legacy, I want to, you know, take IndyCar, make it even better. And obviously he knows to do that, he needs to step down a little bit. So I expect him to be less involved with the team. You know, again, literally every race he was still on the pit box, you know, calling one of the team's races its strategy right through the end of this season, literally through the day he got approached by Tony George, which was on the grid at Laguna Seca, the final race of the season. So he's saying he's going to, you know, make it a clear line. I still think it'll be interesting to watch. His guys are always in the hunt for the win.
Right.
So
can you own the track and the race and the team and
So something's going to come up at some point where, you know, another driver for another team might say something to the camera about, oh, this is convenient or something. Something like that is going to happen in the coming years is what I suspect at some point. That's my guess. And when it happens, it'll be interesting to see how it's dealt with and things like that. But again, you know, a lot of – Roger has the respect in the industry where he's the only person that could probably pull something like this off. But because he's Roger Penske, he probably can pull it off.
Yeah, as much as the Frances owned – stock car racing, they did not own a race team, right? Did not own a race team. And that's
correct.
Different.
The, Lisa France Kennedy's son, Ben Kennedy, who is now getting into the business side, he did compete a little bit in the truck series, but they never owned a team. He was just competing for a different team. So it's definitely nowhere near the same thing.
So put a bow on this for us. What do we look for next? What do we look for? What's the next step with this?
I think what to look out for is where does he start investing in Indianapolis Motor Speedway? How much money does he, you know, spend? Where does he spend it? Does he start looking at doing things like mixed use developments, even on top of trying to improve the speedway itself? As far as kind of, you know, it'll be interesting to see on the business side and the structure of IndyCar and kind of the overall entity, they've kind of been, the previous ownership has been kind of merging the two together. Do they kind of separate that and keep them as, and make them more like separate entities? And or do they bring them together and have more consolidation? Is there any executive changes? Currently, he said he, you know, Roger says he's planning to keep the executive is the same, but a year from now, is everyone still in the same place? That'll be interesting to see. And so I think there's going to be a lot of layers here to unpack. You know, there's even a NASCAR angle to it. You know, does this kind of hasten the ability to have a NASCAR IndyCar doubleheader? Roger is someone who really wants that to happen. So it could. Also, one other thing I'd say is there's been a lot of talk about guaranteed entries into the Indy 500.
Yes.
It's never happened before. It's something that is almost sacrilegious to a lot of Indy 500 fans. And yet Roger –
there goes bump day, right?
Right. And yet Roger, when he was a team owner last year, he was strongly in favor of it. So that's something a lot of people will be watching out for. Does it ultimately happen? And if it does happen in terms of guaranteed entries, does it happen for 2020 or maybe in the years beyond that?
All right. You're all over it. Great stuff. Great stuff. Also this week, you're all over esports, right? Or as I like to call it, competitive video gaming, because, you know, I hate that. I hate that word. I hate that word, esports. I'll be on the record. So you're all over video gaming. What to look for in that package for our readers?
Yeah, for that, we've got a couple different interesting –
because, you know, that's the head everybody wants to know about and nobody understands it.
Yeah, we've got a couple of different interesting pieces kind of hopefully helping people out from that regard. So we spoke to a couple team owners about what they've learned from traditional team owners.
Right.
About what they've learned in esports. We spoke with Zach
Leonsis, right?
And Dave Scott from Comcast Spectacor,
right,
Chairman and CEO. So we've got some takes from them about, hey, here's what we've been able to transfer from esports to traditional sports, and here's what we've been able to transfer the other way from what we know from traditional sports to esports. We've got a piece on franchising.
Looked a lot at the franchise model, right?
Yeah, we got a piece kind of looking at, hey, is franchising really the right way for all esports leagues? And for the leagues that have already done it, were they properly priced in terms of their expansion fees and things like that? We spoke to a ton of different team executives, owners, and so that's definitely something to look out for.
So is there a consensus on the pricing?
I think, you know, people still think that
people who pay think they paid too much, and people who got paid don't think they got enough, like in all the other deals
Mark Cuban had these comments calling it an awful business in the U.S. And I think what a lot of people said is that, you know, if you want to go off of the viewership right now, he might be right, but we're betting in the long term that he's going to be wrong. And that in the long term, this will pay off. And that, you know, for example, we spoke to Tucker Roberts, who is the president of the Philadelphia Fusion. Right. He's also the son of Comcast CEO Brian right. Roberts. And he said, hey, we're in the top of the first, top of the bottom of the first inning of esports. And so it's still very early on. Zach Leoncha said something similar. He's like, a lot of people want to judge this against the NBA, but the NBA has been around for decades and decades. Or he didn't just say the NBA, but other traditional right. sports. Sure, sure. So I think a lot of
An NBA and an NHL owner, so those are natural parallels.
So I think a lot of the investors feel like, hey, look, it's still early on. We're still feeling confident. But there's still a lot, you know, even some of these guys are saying, yeah, we don't know for sure if we paid properly yet, if the expansion fees were the proper price. Yeah, we'll know within 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. So there's that story. And then we also did a piece kind
of facilities, right?
Looking at all the different kind of, you know, with all obviously esports is digitally based. It's a digital sport. But that being said, they're increasingly needing physical locations. So we looked at some of the different arenas, the purpose-built arenas being built for this, some different sponsorship branded lounges like what Twitch is doing at the new Raider Stadium at Allegiant Stadium. And then we even spoke with Allied Esports, which is kind of like an esports infrastructure company, about their deal with Simon Property Group, the largest mall owner in the U.S., about how Simon is trying to build esports arenas to try and turn their malls into more experience-based places as they try and battle e-commerce. So we got a nice little package for
really good stuff. Whether you're champion or skeptic, whichever one of those you might want to fit into, you'll want to take a look. Adam Stern, great stuff. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
First Look is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. If you're a fan of our podcast, subscribe on your mobile device to have First Look delivered right to your phone every Monday morning. If you pay any attention to college football at all, and really, even if you don't, you've certainly heard of the Heisman Trophy, and maybe even the Outland Trophy, and maybe the Nagurski Trophy. But have you heard of the Scoop? How about Chief Caddo? No? No on the Scoop? No on Chief Caddo? Well, you'll want to sit down with us now as we pick the brain of our Brett McCormick, who for the past month or so has been diving ever so deep into the world of college football rivalries and the trophies that go along with them, like the Scoop, which is a replica of the wooden scoops used to harvest cranberries in the early 1900s. Right, Brett?
Yes. And thousands of more facts like that available upon request.
It's such a good package. It is really, dude, congratulations. It's such a good package. Obviously, a ton of effort went into it. You decided to take that because we know, like most people who follow college football would know the old Oaken bucket, right? Or yeah. They might know any of those regionally, those trophies, or just the name of a rivalry or something like that, that sort of plays off of and in some ways becomes a commercial opportunity around these rivalries that are the cornerstone of college football. You took a deep dive and found way more, I bet, than even you expected.
For sure. Yeah. And just to clarify, so we picked traveling trophies because how would you make a list of rivalries?
Right.
That's very subjective.
Right. So, I mean, I would like to, yeah. We'll talk about the world's largest outdoor cocktail party if you'd like, you know, right. As a Gator, I'm more than happy. Although I didn't like the way it went this year. So,
right.
So no, we won't, but it doesn't have a trophy. And so many of these do.
Yeah. So trophies gave us something that we could grasp onto.
Right.
If your rivalry has a trophy, it's 90% chance that it's a legitimate big deal. From there, I found all these lists online, started with a Wikipedia list of college football rivalries, one of HBCU rivalries, and then went through those and tried to double check. And I came up with this spreadsheet that had 225 of them on there. We looked at not just the FBS level,
right.
You've got
right.
Paul Bunyan's axe and the iron skillet and, all these other ones. Where we found the best ones was Division II, Division III.
Right, which really NAI. I had no idea.
Right, right. Division III loves a trophy. 61 of them, which was the second most of any of the levels. There were probably, I would say, 15 that I stumbled upon randomly, which those are the worst for somebody like me doing research.
Right.
Because then that makes you think about all the other ones.
How many
might
have
out
missed.
There in
yeah,
the wild.
Yeah.
I came up with what I think is a pretty comprehensive list. There's 225. I had this idea that probably at least 50% of them or so would be sponsored. It felt like
right.
This seems like an obvious way to make money for
right.
schools.
Right.
Especially at a lower level. And I would say I was pretty shocked that it was 14%. Yeah. So there was 32 of the 225 games had a sponsor. Pretty much everybody I talked to in this story, you know, most of whom would be connected with games that were sponsored,
right,
was surprised by that. Like, but I think a lot of people would be surprised by that because it feels like
it's a natural opportunity.
Yeah, and sponsorship is such a huge part of college sports now that it just felt like it would have been a lot more than that.
Well, and that's – I remember the first conversation we had about this. We were talking about that cranberry scoop, right? Because for years it was sponsored by who else but
– Ocean Spray.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
This was one of the best – this was one of the most like on-brand sponsorships there was in college football. It ended this year. Ocean Spray is undergoing some they've changed their business tactics. Yeah, they started sponsoring it in 2006. And honestly, the Cranberry Bowl first had sponsorship or corporate involvement in 1979, which might be the earliest of any of them.
Right.
Ocean Spray would put on this little pregame banquet kind of a couple days before
we got to back up for a second. I just realized we never mentioned.
Yeah.
This is the teams.
Right.
The schools in this are
Bridgewater State and Mass Maritime.
Right. So exactly. So we're talking about Division III's that were able to do to land an Ocean Spray sponsorship in Division III.
Yeah, it's Southeastern Massachusetts. It's kind of a spiritual home of cranberries. Actually, Wisconsin actually produces more cranberries than Massachusetts.
Another fact
I learned during this. But Massachusetts, I think, is still kind of the home of cranberries. That's where Ocean Spray is based. They're actually based right near Bridgewater State. It stemmed from there. You know, I found this Cranberry Bowl and I love the name. It was like very regionally appropriate. They were the jumping off point for all of this.
So Northwestern State and Stephen F. Austin has to be the biggest of the trophies, right?
Yeah, I think it's the biggest. It's not the heaviest. It's absolutely
it's not the heaviest.
No, the Fremont Cannon.
So this thing is 400 pounds?
Yeah.
Chief Cato, right?
Yeah, he's almost eight feet tall. The photos are hysterical. They're having these.
Do they carry him around?
They do, and it's multiples of them. Yeah, no, we've got one photo that's it's five big offensive linemen. You know, they've got Chief Cato on their shoulders. But they come in all shapes and sizes. I mean, he's the tallest one. So the photos are really hysterical. The post game, these guys are fired up, and you know the coach has got everybody gathered around, and there's just this giant statue of this Native American chief who could be outside of any cigar store in America, you know, just standing right next to the entrance with a bear of the same size on the other side. I mean, it's almost like they got him from there. But that trophy came from a 2,000-pound log, was carved by an alum of one of the schools. I don't remember which. And I think it was something like 200 hours or whatever to carve it, which makes sense because there's a lot of detail. But I mean, the stories of these trophies are like amazing. Like I told you before, this story could have been an entire magazine because each one of these trophies has kind of a, you know, some funny backstory behind it.
So the commercial aspect of it, though, what did you find there?
I'm not advocating for these games to be sponsored, but it feels like in this day and age of state budgets getting slashed, education budgets being decreased, it feels like a missed opportunity. Out of 225 traveling trophy games, 32 were sponsored. Let's see, there was 13 of them in the FBS level. That was the most. And of the 13, a lot of those, like I would say more than 50% of those were like all sports series.
Right.
So like the year-long thing. That's pretty popular.
So that's Oregon State, for example, right?
Yeah.
The Civil War.
Boeing sponsors the Apple Cup, does a year-long thing. I believe Bedlam has one, Oklahoma and Oklahoma State.
Right.
So those are getting pretty popular because the sponsor kind of gets this year-long exposure.
And they build that out to a full menu. That's not one sponsor, right? I mean, they have category by category for some of those, right?
For Oregon,
yeah.
Some of them have done just one. Oregon did categories of exclusivity, which I thought was like pretty clever. So they've got like casino/resort, automotive, healthcare, I want to say hotel, and there's one other one. I can't remember.
All tied to just that series.
Yeah. And so, but it's interesting because they get a year-long exposure. So, you know, in the spring with the softball game, in the winter with the presumably the indoor track and field or something.
Right,
I don't know.
Right.
You're getting different groups of parents and people that are seeing it. I think that's a smart idea. Division II had 9 games sponsored. FCS had 8 games sponsored. Another interesting aspect, this could even be like a separate story at some point, and it was broken out in this one, but how HBCU classics, like how HBCUs use these games to generate a lot of revenue.
Bayou Classic is probably
the standard bearer, but I found one 2 days ago. Like one of the last ones I found was the Tuskegee Morehouse Classic has around 50 different sponsors, which would be the most of anybody on this list. So probably mostly local, but Bayou Classic, I mean, has turned the Grambling Southern rivalry into, they have a national sponsorship platform because they don't hide the fact that they take advantage of, this is access to a group of minority people, you right. know? And so for certain companies, you know, they do, I mean, the Bayou Classic is a week long event. You know, I mean, it's not just a football game. I mean, they do a lot of stuff and there's a lot of companies that are really interested in recruiting minority students. So they're getting involved right. with that. For that reason, there's a lot of companies that want to target a minority consumer base. Dottie Belletto, who's in charge of the Bayou Classic, had told me that both schools are getting close to bringing home $1 million each
right.
from that game. And I mean, that's nothing to slap.
Well, and then also, you know, there's the huge benefit there is that's a nationally televised game, right? And so, right. and so you're really looking at it. You're looking at a different sponsor portfolio as a result of that. But they did have to, now there was a huge transition there, right? A few years
yeah.
ago. You go
yeah.
tell me about that.
That's interesting on two fronts. So on one front, State Farm was a title sponsor. Right. So Dottie Belletto runs the New Orleans Convention Company, and they run the game for right. Southern and right. Grambling. Southern and Grambling own the game. And then NOCCI is the
manages
company,
it,
runs it for them. They found early on that a lot of people thought State Farm owned the game,
right?
Because they had a really prominent title sponsorship presence. So they worked to kind of unravel that. And she had nice things to say about State right. Farm, but that was.
But they really overshadowed the entire. They
had a very large
presence. You could not be another sponsor in there.
They had
really,
a very yeah. large presence. Yeah. She told me also they had zero local sponsors in 2011, which. You know, I think for any game, regardless of the level, local sponsorship is probably where you want to look first. You've got very few games that are going to have a sponsor that's a national corporation that's not connected to your right. community. So if you're thinking about, like, if you're a Division II or III school thinking about how to do this, start local. You start right around your community. I mean, we had there were games that were sponsored by the two State Farm agents in the two communities.
Right.
So, I mean, which is a perfect smart way to start. Ocean Spray was right down the right. street from Bridgewater State, you know, so that was a way to start. And so they've built out with the Bayou Classic, they've gone from zero to, I think it was 10 or 11 local sponsors. And then from there, you know, they were able to start building out and taking advantage of kind of the national presence that they had. But that really struck with me. She was like, you know, it's not complicated. You don't,
right.
you don't start at the top, you build out locally and then go from there. And, you know, I thought that was really smart. And that also, the State Farm part also spoke to kind of an aspect that somebody else mentioned to me, somebody connected with Learfield IMG, which was, you don't want the sponsorship to interrupt the fan experience. So you don't want them to trip over the rivalry because they see this name of a company that gives them a moment to pause, like, wait, what is that doing
right.
here? While I think sponsorship of these games is great and smart, you have to be very careful about how you do it. Because, I mean, you can think back to, like, Michigan and Ohio State, whose rivalry was sponsored for one day in 2004 before the fan bases like revolted and they had to cancel the deal like the next day. I mean, somebody said to me, the sponsors don't want to alienate the fan
right.
bases
that's right.
that they're trying to speak to. So they don't want to get into something that's going to make them look bad. So, you know, they understand that and that this is not like for schools, this is not a weird request for them to say like, we appreciate your support. We want it, but it kind of needs to be in the background a little bit.
Right.
You know, which I thought that made great sense because that's how you do it without ticking off people.
So are you going to be okay next week when you find one more that you didn't know about?
Absolutely not. And it's going to enrage me, but I will add it. I will add it to the list that's online and update that.
All right, there you go. So, all things rivalry and all things trophy. Brett McCormick, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That's going to do it for this week. For Adam Stern, Brett McCormick, and our producer, Chris Mason, I'm Bill King, and this has been First Look.